What we're seeing here in this passage of Scripture is a group of people who are family by birth, but enemies at heart. This battle that they're having from within. We sang the song, "Come, Love Each Other." But to do that, we realize there's the battle that we have within us as creations of God. We are from the dirt, so were the animals created from the dirt. But we are filled and breathed with God's Spirit, which the animals didn't receive the likeness of God. They weren't filled with God's Spirit that way. So the tension that we find ourselves in is the desire to be godly and live into that part of our nature, but then there's many times when we act ungodly or more beastly. Do you ever find yourself in that tension? Do you ever assume you're going to overcome that tension? I don't think that we'll overcome that tension until we are fully in the presence of God, and our old nature is fully transformed. But in the time now, we notice this is going on. And in the process now, we try to manage that nature, and sometimes it just gets the best of us. Proverbs calls it folly. Better the poor whose walk is blameless than the fool whose lips are perverse. Desire without knowledge is not good. How much more will hasty feet miss the way? A person's own folly leads them to ruin. Yet their heart rages against the Lord. So there's that thing in us as we want to be the masters of our own destiny. We think we know the right way. But God knows the right way. And we see in this tension with Jephthah and the Ephraimites, what is going on here? Well, there's an accusation made. There's an insult made. Or someone felt insulted. The Ephraimite says, well, you Gileadites are just really Ephraimites who are runaways. So basically, you are people of lower status of our people that we just didn't want to have anything to do with anyway. So then that gives us the right to look at you in a demeaning way. So we see in the nature of humanity, what happens a lot of times is we don't want to see each other as fellow humans. We feel the need to put ourselves over another group of people so that there's a sense within ourselves of superiority, that our kingdom is being built. You're just a bunch of renegades. You're illegitimate. And isn't that what Jephthah dealt with within his own family? Because his mother was a prostitute and his half-brothers were saying, you have no right for full inheritance in our family. Just leave. And here they were, even though he was the son of a prostitute, spiritually what they were doing were prostituting themselves to other forms of leadership. Things that met their needs their way. Until things got tough and God backed off and says, well, if you want those things to lead your life, I'll let you choose that. I will back off and let the consequences for your choices affect you. And once they realized, oh no, I did something really stupid because I can't really see what's best for me. I can just feel what's best for me. And when I allow my feeling of what's best for me trump what is truly best for me from the one who created me, that's where the trouble begins. And we see the problem with the Ephraimites in Jephthah is this. It's about pecking order. That's what it means, is I need to see myself above another. And do you realize where that phrase comes from? Well, the barnyard, right? Because chickens will peck to legitimize a hierarchy. So the one that is pecked the most is of lower standing. So we see this in the playground, at schools, in movies, about how people demean, defame, dehumanize others to put them in their place, the place I want them to be, because the place I want is up here, and if I can't put you beneath me, then that's a problem. Because I need to feel superior. So what the chickens are doing in the barnyard is they're having a hierarchy by aggression. In a verbal society, it's verbal aggression, name-calling. And in our name-calling, it's not about identifying their God-like traits. It's emphasizing their godless traits. As I focus on my godly traits and try to forget my godless traits. And when I'm doing that, all I'm doing is saying, I'm just like you. But in my mind, I have to believe I'm better than you. And if I think I'm better than you, then I can demean you, dehumanize you. And I can feel okay about it. If you remember back in chapter 8 of Judges, same kind of thing happened. The Ephraimites asked Gideon, why didn't you call us out when you first were battling the peoples that were overcoming our nations? And Gideon, instead of treating them as he was being treated, he says, who's better than you guys? When you did come out and fight, didn't you come and just take control of the battlefield and win those battles? And weren't you part of the delivering of our people? And they said, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. And it's almost like the Ephraimites just want to pick a fight. Or they feel like, well, if I'm slighted in any way, I've got to get my hackles all raised up and I've got to put you in your place, or you got to validate me as something special because I think you've dehumanized me. So it's all about the ego. So Ephraim, they're feeling slighted. They're feeling rejected. They're also feeling superior. Unlike Gideon, Jephthah responds to them feeling slighted, feeling rejected as their leader. We won't follow you because you're beneath us. And because of that, he feels superior. So what do you think is going to happen when you have two groups of people who are already feeling slighted, feeling rejected, and feeling superior? War. And that's exactly what happens. We see their personal empowerment because they think someone else has the ability to devalue them. And they're really giving that person the power to devalue them. They don't have to agree. But when you agree that you're less and what they're saying could be true, then, well, I've got to prove that I'm not. Who are you proving that to? Well, to them. They need to know. They need to be put in their place. Because that's truth. That's standing for truth. But what it's really standing for is my position. trying to gain back my power so that I don't feel demeaned. It's really about building our own kingdom. So then what happens is personal insults. It's the tearing down of the perceived threat. And at its lowest level, it's dehumanizing the other person so that I have permission in my mind to treat them unlike a human being. Just read your history books. It's everywhere. Personal pride needing to be validated by trying to eliminate the things that are attacking in my mind my sense of worth and value. But there's no one who determines your value other than the one who made you. And when we feel like we're being demeaned by others, we really might be. But if you don't trust in their evaluation, it won't bother you. But when you trust their evaluation, it's going to bother you, and you're going to, well, I got to do something. I either got to make myself better because I don't feel very good about myself and I can slink off into a hole, or I can puff up and say, oh yeah? And that's the two things humans tend to do to the extreme. They either go away and hide, or they puff up and fight. And these feelings of inferiority are really what are driving the insult, isn't it? At one level. Because if I feel inferior, I somehow have to gain that superiority back. So if you're going to call me something to demean me, I've got to call you something to demean you. Or the other thing is I already feel superior. And that's what a narcissist does. Because a narcissist already believes that you're beneath them. And they have to make sure you know it. Because that just continues to foster their narcissistic perspective of, there's no one better than me. And there's levels and grades of narcissism. But one of the things that we're finding in our culture through studies at colleges is narcissism is growing in our country. So how do you think that's going to play out in people's interactions with one another? Is that whenever I feel like you're demeaning me in any possible way, I've got to make sure that you know that's not true. And the way I do that is by putting you in the place I think you deserve. But it's interesting that the place that we deserve is no different than their place. Because I'm just like them. And when we get into these battles, we see what it cost the tribe of Ephraim. 2,400 people die. All because I need you to see who I am in my eyes. What do you think would have happened? And we talked, if you haven't seen the class before this in Romans, go back and watch the class because they meld together. Of how we are interacting or supposed to interact with one another. The way we respond will reflect the nature in which and for which we're living for. So when we react like an animal, you are acting out of the fleshly nature. But when you respond like God responds to those who deserve nothing but destruction, but offers them life and hope, then you're acting out of God's nature. And what do we see? Is we respond to these insults with anger? Because why? Why do we respond to insult with anger? It might not be true. And I'm all about truth, so I'm going to tell you what's true. And they're thinking, I don't care about your truth. This is my truth. This is who you are to me. And then we have to decide if it's going to matter to me what they think of me. Dan?
Responding with anger shuts down that situation and brings it into a different one. So the guilt of you is gone now, and this person has to deal with the anger, so it's into something else.
Right, and we use anger as a shield, a boundary, a barrier. Because if I can push you back and get some space for you with my anger, okay, I can breathe now. But the problem is the reason you can't breathe is because you trust what they're saying about you more than you trust what God is saying about you. Or you're already saying these things about yourself, and they are saying it too, and you don't want to hear it from someone else, even though you're saying it to yourself all day long. And we think about love each other, it has to start with ourselves too, folks, right? We have to be able to see ourselves from God's vantage point. So we can respond with anger, or we can accept what they're saying. We have to ask, okay, they said this, is it true? So how do you figure out if it's true or not? Okay, self-reflection, or if it's hard for you to know whether that's true about you or not, you talk to other people that are safe for you, that know you, and you say, you know, someone said this about me. Do you see that? And the reason we can do that is because we're not taking their statement as truth. We're taking God's statement as truth, is that we're given his image. And if they see something, we just said, well, if that's reflecting my human nature, my earthly nature that I'm trying to get away from, I'm not going to get angry about it. I'm going to find out if it's true. And if it is, that doesn't mean I'm less valuable, because I'm just as valuable as they are, because God's given everyone their value. Oh, see how that works? But Satan doesn't want us to think about it that way. He doesn't want to see us as we're all humans, we all have the same value because we're made in the image of God. And trust that. We want to trust that when someone says something that makes me feel like I'm already feeling, that I need to manage that some way. And if it's not true, then we consider the source. Consider why they said it. Maybe what they said is more about them than it is about you. Maybe, like the Ephraimites, they see Jephthah's going, you know, we looked at him as an outcast and just one of those people we just throw to the side, and they're not as good as us, those people. And now he's going to be the head over all of us? Well, I don't like that. I don't want to follow him because he's beneath me. Why would I want to follow him? So it's not about Jephthah. It's about the Ephraimites. But what we do is we generally personalize everything. That other people's actions is all about us. But that's not always true. So we have to go to those safe people to help us figure that out. Or we could return an insult. There was one article I was reading in Psychology Today about how these insults work. And it said one actress had written a book, and someone said, wow, I got your book and I read it, and it's really good. Who wrote it for you? And their response was, oh, I'm so glad you loved my book. Who read it to you? And we might think, oh, well, that's snappy. I want to use that one. But what is that? But what is that really doing? It's really what we call tit for tat, right? It's eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. So even though we might feel good and walk away from it, like I put them in their place, and oftentimes when we say that, where is their place? Down here. It's not about validating their humanity, that they're just like me, but different in many ways. But it's more about me wanting to feel superior. And we could use humor. And we're going to see that with the man who was born blind in a minute here. Or we could just ignore it. Yeah, they can say whatever they want. I know who I am. Or we could just rebuke people. But is it going to cost 24,000 dead brothers and sisters so that I can feel superior to others? In Proverbs 22:2, it says, the rich and poor are just alike, because the Lord makes them both. We carry that image of God. And this idea of anger that can come, where does it come from? It comes from the heart. In James 4, it talks about the same thing. Where does these problems come from? It's because of the things that are within you. Jesus tells people, you know, you're told, do not murder. But I tell you, don't be angry with a brother or sister, or you'll be subject to judgment. Again, if you say to your brother or sister, Raka, you're going to be answerable to the courts. And anyone who says you fool will be in dangers of the fires of hell. So if someone's going to say something at you with anger, you don't want to eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. Because it's not God's eyes, nor are they God's words. The man born blind, Jesus asked, do you want to become healed? Sure I do. Heals him, pick up your mat and walk. It's a Sabbath. Jesus is encouraging law-breaking from the Pharisees' mindset. And they say, what are you doing carrying your mat? Well, the guy who healed me said to pick up my mat and walk. Well, who is this guy? He says, I don't know who he is. I just know I was blind and now I see. That's all I know. That's truth. They even went and asked his parents, was this man really born blind? And they were afraid to get in trouble because they, again, were feeling put underneath the rulers of the Israelites. He said, ask him, he's of age. He says, this guy who did this, who is this guy? We don't believe he's the Messiah. He goes, now that's remarkable to me. You don't know where he's from, yet he opened my eyes. He says, we, and he's being inclusive here, we know that God does not listen to sinners, that he listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. To this they replied, you were steeped at birth from sin. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. You vagabond of humanity. It's interesting, when they asked again, he says, do you want to be his disciples too? The last they wanted to do. And to be his disciple is to follow this king to where he leads. And as Jesus is led to his crucifixion, not because anything he deserved, but because of the actions, the insults, and accusations of others who didn't want him to be their king, he's nailed to a cross. And even those who are thieves and murderers on his right and his left are insulting him. Those who are passing in front of him are insulting him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from that cross if you're the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders mocked him. He saved others. He can't even save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusts in God? Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, "I am God's son." In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. And isn't it interesting that the thing they wanted Jesus to do to prove himself to them as their Messiah would negate the reason that Jesus came to be their Messiah? You don't want me to come down from this cross. Because if I don't die for you, you're going to die because of you. And in this we see the heart of God. That even though his humanity tries to puff itself up over and above him and wants to be their own God, he will continue to do what they need, what's in their best interest, and call them into that relationship. And Peter, who's watching all this, later writes, "They hurled insults at him. He did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threat. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly." Because Jesus is loving others unlike how any other would love them. And it's in this love that will overcome their sin. In spite of the cost, he has to pay for that to happen. He bore our sin in his body on the cross so that we might die to sin and live for righteousness. Dying to that beastly nature and live into that God-formed nature. Because by his wounds we're healed. I want you to listen to this. He doesn't say, "By his wounds, you're a little bit better." He doesn't say, "By his wounds, you're on your way to full health." It's by his wounds, you are healed. And what is healed? It's that divided relationship between humanity and God. The thing that we want the most, that will last for eternity. The thing that matters the most, not my physical body, but my spiritual life with the God who created me to be in communion with him for eternity. And it's by his wounds we're healed. Because we were like sheep going astray. But when we trust, he is the one who is the healer of our soul, the guide of our life, then we will let him be the shepherd and overseer of our soul. We will follow, but will it be on our terms or his terms? And if I say, "I will only follow you, but it's going to be on my terms," am I really following? Or am I just walking alongside until I don't like it anymore? Or do we say, "As long as I agree with you, I will follow you"? Are we really following? Paul understands that there's some times when he wants something that he's not going to get. He had a thorn in the flesh and he pleaded to God to take it away. But he said, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in your weakness. Just let that one flow over your ears for a minute. God is saying, my power, his power, is made perfect in my weakness. My beastly nature wants to prove to other people I'm not weak. But my godly nature says, you are the source of my breath, you are the source of my life, and I understand that full well. And when I feel weak in the flesh, in my animal nature, I'm going to lean into my godly nature. And that too is going to be a struggle all my life. But we do it together. We do it with one another, for one another. He says, so therefore I boast in all the more gladly about my weakness. So when someone insults you and wants to point out your weakness, why get angry? Yeah, I am. And all of a sudden they're going, oh man, I don't have power over them. They're not letting me control their minds and their emotions. Oh, I need to control their minds and their emotions, or I feel like I'm weak. Oh, so this is really about you and not me. No, you're just a tool so I can feel better about myself. Oh, I see how it works. And this is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in my weakness, Paul says, in insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties, for when I'm weak, that's when I'm strong, because my strength doesn't come from me, it comes from God. And when I feel weak and understand I'm weak and I'm trusting in God, then my responses are going to be more godly to the one who's being evil towards me. And we have to ask ourselves, will I follow even when it's hard to understand why I've got this thorn in my flesh, why I got this situation going on in my life? Will I follow when it's hard to commit? When I'm being persecuted, or when I'm looked down upon because of the way I believe about the world and how I treat other people? Will I follow when it's not my will being done? And will I be like Jesus, who says, Father, if there's any way, take this cross away from me. Take this cup away from me. He always gets back to, thy will be done. And when the people said, come down off the cross, please us, do our will to prove yourself, he says, that does not do my Father's will for you. And he doesn't retaliate. He says, Father, forgive them. They have no clue of what they do. So we're called to live worthy, to lean more into that spiritual nature. He says, finally, all of you, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another. And we do that because we understand we're all each like each other. Be compassionate and humble. Don't repay evil with evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with a blessing. Well, then they're going to think that they're better than me then. So what? Oh yeah, that's my beastly nature, my pride, my arrogance, thinking I've got to put them in their place. No, let God do that. Because God knows their place better than you do. And guess what? If they repent, and if they're trying like you are, guess what? Their place is going to be the same as your place with him in eternity, in spite of how they've treated you on earth. Because how have you treated other people in ways that you didn't deserve to be there either? Give a blessing, because you were called. This is to what you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil Keep your tongue from insult, dehumanizing, or is it going to be uplifting and loving? Sometimes we're going to have to speak the truth that people aren't going to hear, but that's loving too. But it's the means and the manner in which we do it. Speaking the truth, as Paul says, with love. Not about pride. They must turn from evil and do good. They must seek peace and pursue it. And Paul will say, as long as it's up to you, live at peace with everyone. Don't you be the cause for division. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. So what kingdom do your words and your actions promote? And whatever you decide there, that is where your hope is. And know that Satan is going to try to get you to lean into your beastly nature, to destroy peace, to destroy relationship, to destroy you, to destroy that image of God that lives within you. But when we battle that and say, I'm not going to believe the things others say about me who are unsafe for me, I'll believe those things that others say about me that I trust. And if it's not good, I'll embrace it and say, help me overcome. Because that's why we're here as a family too. Not to destroy one another, but to lift up, encourage, support, and maybe sometimes call one another out so that we too share the eternal blessing and that no one misses it because we've just let them get away with it. But some people will be told truth and walk away. And Jesus allowed that time and time again. So we ask the question, is your heart right with God? Have your diseases been healed by the blood of Jesus? Does he see you as white and clothed in Christ? Then we believe that truth and walk out of here living that truth in relationship to others who are Christian or not Christian. And we treat them as we have been treated, loving others as Christ loved us and died for us. If you're not sure if you've been healed, let's talk. But whatever your need is, the family of God is there to help meet that need because the family of God is the arms and the heart of our Father in heaven. So whatever need you have, you can come forward as we stand and sing.